Good morning. This is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated October 10th, 2016. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, "The Walls Do Have Ears," subtitled, "Torrid Letters Found in Attic Spark Woman to Pen Historical Novel." This is an article out of Decatur by Tony Reed. Lynn and Dwayne Potter like to hunt for any hidden treasure that might be hidden in the succession of grand old Decatur houses they have renovated over the past half century. But what they found entombed in the attic of the prestigious home at 3 Milliken Place was an emotional time bomb. Lynn Potter, writing under the name Mary Lynn, has just published a novel based on the discovery called The Forgotten Life of Sarah Grady. It has naughty sexual liaisons, deep passion, domestic violence, mystery, and death energizing the plot like high-voltage cables. "The story is really sad, but it's also true," Lynn Potter says. So back to that discovery in the attic, which started it all. The Potters had moved into the house in 1968, and several seasons after confronting heating bills that looked like telephone numbers with dollar signs in front of them, decided to get the attic of the 5,400-square-foot arts and crafts-style mansion insulated. Dwayne Potter had been dispatched to the attic to check the job was done right when he noticed an insulation-covered lump sticking out from behind a chimney. His heart leaping to the conclusion this must be the long-lost treasure they had always dreamed of finding, he uncovered a 2-by-2-foot cardboard box and hauled it downstairs. Instead of a hoard of gold coins, he found stacks of letters, more than 400 of them, along with tickets, receipts, and other ephemera dated between 1915 and 1920. Some of the letters used Morse code and other forms of code to try and render their contents secret to prying eyes. Cautious at first about prying into other people's lives, the Potters were quickly seduced by the allure of their find and dug in, Lynn Potter teaching herself Morse and working diligently to crack the other codes used. What the Potters had found were love letters written to the lady of the house, Sarah Grady, from one Ed Rockefeller, a prominent businessman from out east whose family name is related to that much more famous variation of it, Rockefeller. Grady was married to the original owner of the home, Decatur businessman William Grady of the Ferries Manufacturing Company. The house was a gilded palace for her to throw lavish parties as her husband social climbed his way to the top. But it soon became clear she wanted more than to be his social secretary. She longed for intellectual and other forms of stimulation, and the obliging and smart Rockefeller served it up in a torrid 4-year affair. Lynn Potter knew she had enough for a gripping reading, and had long planned to novelize the results by working off the letters. But the former teacher, who spent 25 years as office manager for her dentist's son, never did quite find the time until she retired from her day job. And 2 years ago, and 30 years after moving out of the Milliken Place house, sat down to write like her life depended on it. "We just carried those letters around with us for 40 years before my wife got going on the writing," said Dwayne Potter, who has been married to her for 63 years. "And those letters tell an extremely sad story. One that sometimes had his wife in tears while she was writing it. The author only has the smoking letters Rockefeller wrote to Grady, not the hot correspondence going the other way. So, like in Jurassic Park, where the scientists have to patch the dinosaur DNA, she uses her imagination and clues about what Grady said to her lover by what he writes back to her to flesh out their lives. Slice by slice, a detailed picture emerges of Grady's rich and wretched existence in her luxurious isolation. Sarah was a woman who lived a good life. She had three bathrooms in 1915 when only 18% of homes had one, Lynn Potter says. But she was sad, and she suffered. Without giving too much of the game away, as Potter would like to sell some books, Grady loses a son in 1918 to a worldwide flu epidemic, estimated to have claimed more than 50 million souls. On top of that, her husband was repeatedly arguing with her using his fists, and Rockefeller, the love of her life, made elaborate pledges of devotion, but hesitated to leave his wife and his comfortable life, despite promises to the contrary. That sets the stage for a mysterious fate that is darker than all that precedes it, but you'll have to read the book and decide for yourself if Potter's potent alchemy of mystery and imagination has got it right. Whatever the verdict, it's all good and explosive stuff, well told. Getting that novel written was on my bucket list, Lynn Potter says. She's had rave reviews from the few folks lucky enough to have been given advance copies, but you can never please everybody. One of Potter's young granddaughters had particular trouble reconciling pages tainted by the darker strains of the human condition with the sweet, ever-smiling, blue-eyed grandma who wrote them after dipping her pen in pain. She said, "Why would Grandma write anything like this?" recalls Potter with a smile turned impish. Oh, well. And the sidebar notes that Lynn Potter will talk about her book and sign copies on Thursday, October 13th, during a launch party for The Forgotten Life of Sarah Grady at the Wildflower Artisan Bakery and Cafe, 256 West Main Street, Decatur. The launch party runs from 5 to 7 p.m. with Potter due to speak at 6 p.m. The 325-page book is priced at $13.95 and is available from Potter, who can be reached at pdpotters@aol.com or call 217-428-5759. Also from the front page, jobless aid recovery bad in state. Federal labor unit steps in to reform system. This is from Springfield. Illinois is billions in debt, has billions in overdue bills, and can't seem to remove itself from a budget morass. Yet it's the nation's worst in reclaiming hundreds of millions of dollars in overpaid unemployment benefits, an Associated Press analysis of federal labor data found. The abysmal performance, claiming only about $264 million of the $714 million in overpayments from 2012 to 2016, is one reason the U.S. Labor Department said that it would help Illinois meet standards for management, record-keeping, and timeliness, according to an August 31st letter obtained by the AP under the Illinois Freedom of Information Act. Illinois' 37% recovery rate is the worst among all U.S. states and territories, which average 66%, the AP found. The unclaimed $452 million can't be used to alleviate social services that have suffered because of the state's 21-month budget crisis, because it's earmarked for current legitimate jobless claims or be held in savings to dole out for unemployment in the future. The Illinois Department of Employment Security handles about 600,000 unemployment claims a year and collects $2.3 billion annually in unemployment insurance taxes from employers. But the review shows the department didn't reclaim more than 60% of what it had improperly paid to ineligible claimants who either cashed unemployment checks intentionally through oversight or because they misunderstood the rules after they started working again. The department blames that on two factors that Director Jeffrey Mays said have been reversed. First, the agency relied on months-old employment reports to determine who had been hired and no longer eligible for unemployment benefits. Second, it didn't enforce a federal requirement that those filing for unemployment register with the state and show their job search progress. Those two seemingly simple steps are among those in a multifaceted approach the department is taking to modernize the unemployment insurance program, May said, as well as address timeliness of payments, how it validates data, and other concerns raised by the Labor Department's Employment and Training Administration. With marching orders from Governor Bruce Rauner, May's agency has begun requiring employers of 25 or more to report payroll with their monthly unemployment insurance tax payments so state officials can identify names of new hires and cross-check them with unemployment benefit lists. Since late July, those seeking unemployment benefits must register with the state's online job referral site, and as of October 1st, they must participate in job search assistance, such as skills training or resume building. The goal is to bring people back to work quicker, and you can't do that if they're not registered with you, and you surely can't do that if they're resistant to coming in and working with the systems you've got, Mays said. It's not all Illinois' fault. Federal money helps fund State Unemployment Bureau, and the check from a belt-tightened Washington fell dramatically during the administration of Governor Pat Quinn, from nearly $200 million in 2012 to $150 million this year. So Mays said his predecessor was struggling to maintain program due to staff and operational cuts. Only California has misspent more than Illinois, but it has collected half of that $723 million total and has about triple the amount of unemployment workers as Illinois' 364,000, according to the Labor Department. For comparison, New York has 461,000 unemployed people, misallocated $441 million during the four-year period, but has a 75% recovery rate, according to the AP review. The Labor Department, which first targeted Florida and Pennsylvania last year, considers the federal notice a technical assistance effort and not a public shaming, said spokesman Scott Allen. Designated experts, who assist in making improvements so they can meet department standards for six consecutive months, one requirement to be removed from federal high-priority status. Nevada, with an overpayment recovery rate, is 68%, was singled out with Illinois this year. Jeffrey Frischman, Deputy Administrator for the Employment Security Division of the Nevada Department of Employment, Training and Rehabilitation, says that's because there's wage reporting confusion among workers in the tip-driven casino industry. Illinois' agency is revising dozens of often contradictory letters that explain eligibility to claimants and is advising employers of noncompliance. And it also has partnered with the state's Revenue Department so that businesses will next year be able to pay all their taxes, including unemployment insurance, on one website. And from the front page, presidential campaign goes sexual. Trump's vulgar remarks, alleged Bill Clinton acts, overwhelm debate number two. In a debate brimming with tension, Hillary Clinton declared Donald Trump's aggressively vulgar comments about women revealed exactly who he is, and clearly demonstrated his unsuitability to be president. Firing back, Trump accused Clinton of attacking women involved in her husband's extramarital affairs and declared she would be in jail if he were president. Trump entered Sunday night's debate desperate to steady his floundering campaign. He unleashed a barrage of attacks and insults and continually interrupted Clinton. He repeatedly called her a liar, labeled her the devil, and contended she had tremendous hate in her heart. Trump acknowledged for the first time that he had paid no federal income taxes for many years. The debate was the culmination of a stunning stretch in the race for the White House, which began with the release of a new video in which Trump is heard bragging about how his fame allowed him to do anything to women. Many Republicans rushed to revoke their support, with some calling for him to drop out of the race. Answering for his words for the first time, Trump denied that he had ever kissed and grabbed women without their consent. He said repeatedly that his words in 2005 were merely locker room talk and paled in comparison to what he called Bill Clinton's abuse of women. "She should be ashamed of herself," Trump declared. Ahead of the debate, the businessman met with three women who accused the former president of sexual harassment and even rape, then invited them to sit in the debate hall. Bill Clinton never faced any criminal charges in relation to the allegations, and a lawsuit over an alleged rape was dismissed. He did settle a lawsuit with one of the women who claimed harassment. On the debate stage, Clinton did not respond directly to Trump's accusations about her husband or her own role, but was blistering in her condemnation of his predatory comments about women in the tape released Friday. "I think it's clear to anyone who heard him that it represents exactly who he is," she said, adding that she did not believe Trump had the fitness to serve as commander-in-chief. The second debate was a town hall format with several undecided voters sitting on stage with the candidates. The voters, all from the St. Louis area, were selected by Gallup. The tension between Trump and Clinton was palpable from the start of their 90-minute debate, the second time they have faced off in the presidential campaign. They did not shake hands as they met at center stage. Trump, who is several inches taller than Clinton, stood close behind her as she answered questions from the voters. At other times, he paced the stage, repeatedly interrupting her and criticizing the moderators. The businessman opened the debate with a flood of insults aimed at Clinton, accusing her of having lied about a lot of things and insinuating she was the devil. He struggled to articulate detailed policy proposals, repeatedly dancing around questions about how he would replace President Barack Obama's health care law, a measure he has vowed to replace. Trump made clear that he did not agree with running mate Mike Pence on how to deal with war-torn Syria. Last week, Pence said that the U.S. military should be ready to strike Syrian military targets that are under the command of President Bashar Assad. The threat of military action against the Russian-backed Assad government marks a departure from Trump's preference for a focus on Islamic State targets. Said Trump, "He and I haven't spoken, and I disagree." Trump's campaign was already struggling before the new video was released, due in part to his uneven performance in the first presidential debate. Many Republicans saw Sunday's showdown as his last best chance to salvage his campaign. It was unclear whether Trump's performance did anything to expand his support beyond his core backers. He did repeatedly cast Clinton as a career politician who had accomplished little during her years in Washington and would be incapable of bringing about change, one of his strongest arguments in a campaign that has highlighted America's deep frustration. "With her, it's all talk and no action," Trump said. The new revelations about Trump overshadowed potentially damaging revelations about Clinton's paid speeches to Wall Street firms. Emails released by WikiLeaks last week showed Clinton told a group that it's acceptable for a president to project differing positions in public and private. Asked in the debate whether that's two-faced, Clinton pointed to Abraham Lincoln, saying he did whatever he could to get the 13th Amendment passed, allowing emancipation of the slaves by lawmakers who did not support African-American equality. "I was making the point it is hard sometimes to get the Congress to do what you want them to do. That was a great display of presidential leadership." Rolling his eyes, Trump said, "Now she's blaming the late, great Abraham Lincoln." The political firestorm that preceded the debate was sparked by a video obtained and released Friday by the Washington Post and NBC News. In the video, Trump, who was married to his current wife at the time, is heard describing attempts to have sex with a married woman. He also brags to Billy Bush of Access Hollywood about women letting him kiss them and grab their genitals because he is famous. NBC said Sunday that it had indefinitely suspended Bush, now a Today Show personality, for his role in the crude conversation with Trump. Trump used the revelations as an opening to make good on his repeated promises to throw Bill Clinton's sexual history into the center of his campaign against his wife. Less than 2 hours before the debate, he brazenly met publicly with several women who have accused Bill Clinton of unwanted sexual advances and even rape. Trump refused to answer questions from reporters about his own aggressive sexual remarks about women during the meeting in a hotel conference room with Paula Jones, Juanita Broderick, and Kathleen Willey. Kathy Shelton, a fourth woman who appeared with Trump, was a 12-year-old Arkansas sexual assault victim whose alleged assailant was defended by Hillary Clinton. Some of the women seated alongside him, however, were graphic in their accusations against the Clintons. "Mr. Trump may have said some bad words, but Bill Clinton raped me and Hillary Clinton threatened me," Broderick said. "I don't think there's any comparison." Broderick, a former Arkansas nursing home administrator, first claimed 17 years ago that Bill Clinton raped her during a meeting in Little Rock in 1978. Her lawsuit against him was dismissed in 2001, and criminal charges were never filed. Clinton has denied the allegations. And from the local page, Valerie Wells, Herald and Review staff writer, writes, "Boy backs parties for needy. Fundraising starts for birthday boxes so that kids can celebrate." And this from Decatur. "When Tommy Werkheiser turned 9 in August, his parents gave him a birthday party. That's not unusual, but soon after that, Tommy and his mother, Amanda, were driving back to his school after a doctor's appointment. Tommy had missed lunch at school, so his mother bought him a Happy Meal at McDonald's. They passed an intersection where a man was standing with a sign asking for help. Amanda Werkheiser admitted she barely glanced at the man. One sees so many of them. You kind of get immune to it," she said. "We turned past the intersection and Tommy said, 'We need to go help that man.' I said, 'We help people in other ways. We're active in our church and do service work there and community things.' That wasn't good enough for Tommy, who said the man might be hungry and he wanted to give him the Happy Meal. Then it occurred to Tommy that the man might have kids. He said, 'If that man has children, I'll give him my Happy Meal to give to his kids,' Werkheiser said. So I explained about food pantries and places people can go to get food. Tommy kept thinking about it, and that evening he brought up the birthday parties. 'If people don't have money for food, they can't give their children a birthday party,' he said. He wanted to donate birthday cakes to help people like that. His mother told him cakes wouldn't keep fresh and suggested cake mix as an alternative, which they could take to food pantries, and explained that they wanted the mix and frosting to go to a child who had an upcoming birthday. 'He said, that isn't good enough. They need a party,' Werkheiser said. Tommy wanted to make sure those children had party favors and noisemakers and everything they'd need for a real birthday celebration," she said. "And what's more, he wanted to pay for the things with the birthday money he'd been saving to buy a Lego set. 'I posted on Facebook, 'I'm so proud of my kid,' she said. Friends saw the post and started offering to donate to the cause so Tommy wouldn't have to spend his birthday money and to raise enough to really do it right." Werkheiser did some figuring and decided $10 would pay for one birthday box, and when friends suggested a GoFundMe page, she set it up. www.gofundme.com/2G2ZZ2NB, and it already has raised more than $400. Tommy's goal was to buy 100 birthday boxes, which he and his mom will deliver to food pantries in Decatur, including Northeast Community Fund, Catholic Charities, and the Salvation Army. His school also has a food pantry for school families in need, and some will go there as well. The items that will go into each box were decided upon by Tommy himself. "Cups, hats, cake mix, frosting, and sprinkles," Tommy said. "Sprinkles because they go with birthdays." Also from Decatur, Tony Reed writes, contest leaves one breathless. DMH CrossFit Tournament gathers athletes devoted to pushing the limits. No Pain, No Gain took on a whole new level of agony over the 2 days of Decatur's DMH CrossFit Enhanced D-Town Throwdown, which wrapped up Sunday afternoon. More than 280 CrossFit athletes on 48 teams came from as far as North Dakota to push themselves to the limit in a series of competitive strength and conditioning workouts. And when they reached those limits, urged on by screaming teammates and thumping rock music, they kept going, only to find it still wasn't enough. "Well, my team is toward the bottom," said a winded Mike Wayne, a 41-year-old accountant from Charleston. "But doing CrossFit gives you such a good feeling afterwards." Wayne was a member of a club called CrossFit 217 that was competing in the Masters division for athletes 40 and older. Masters teams had two men and two women, while athletes under 40 were split into teams of three men and three women. Whatever the age, there was plenty of exhaustion to go around. "It's brutal at times, but it's all worth it," said another CrossFit 217 member, 54-year-old Mark Creed from Mattoon. "It's exciting, exhilarating, and it makes you a stronger person, you know?" Creed had just got done curling his body up and down in an exercise called the Glute Hamstring Developer, which looked like a medieval form of information extraction. Winded, sweating, but emotionally pumped, Creed couldn't stop smiling as people all around him went through the same punishing exercise. "I love the CrossFit community," he added. "It's a great way to stay in shape." But whatever their level of breathlessness, athletes heaped heavy praise on the organizational standard of the Decatur event, which they said was smooth and efficient. That was music to the ears of Darren Butts, the director of health and wellness for Decatur Memorial Hospital, whose CrossFit Enhanced Gym hosts the Throwdown, now in its fourth year. DMH has always been 100% supportive of what we do, so we can hold events like this, Butts said. The Throwdown also attracts a variety of other corporate sponsorship, and it seemed as if all the backing had reached heavenward and secured a perfect weekend. Sunny conditions that weren't too hot or too cold. Spectator-wise, we're up a bit, with at least 400, and I think it's because of the beautiful weather, Butts added. We've been lucky. And this article is accompanied by a photograph. Leah Goldberg, 24, a member of the Snatchtastic Six, a CrossFit team from Springfield, completes an exercise with a 200-meter run while carrying a medicine ball. Another photograph shows a man leaning backward over a machine holding a medicine ball. The Glute Hamstring Developer, an exercise that involves curling the body up and down while holding a 14-pound medicine ball, is one slice of agony available at the DMH CrossFit Enhance D-Town Throwdown Tournament. Mark Creed, 54, of Mattoon, powers through it. And from the local page A3 Briefs, food service class. The Illinois Department of Public Health will teach a food service sanitation manager class with exam to meet the requirement that food establishments be under the supervision of a certified food service sanitation manager during hours of operation. The course will be offered from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Tuesday, November 8th and Thursday, November 10th in the Macon County Extension Office. The exam is 1 to 3 p.m. on Thursday, November 10th. The retest will be at 9 a.m. Tuesday, November 29th, and cost will be $40. The cost of the 2-day course is $115. Register by calling 217-877-6042. And this has been Wendy Bauer. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, October 10th, 2016. Please stay tuned.